Hi, I'm Bill Kristol. Welcome to Conversations. And I'm joined today by, as I have been before, by two excellent analysts of American politics, Spence Abraham, former senator from Michigan, secretary of energy, Michigan state chairman, a longtime political veteran, and Jay Cost, contributing editor of the Weekly Standard, author of books and articles galore, political historian. So the last conversation we had was at the very beginning of August. I think it was the Monday right after the both conventions, if I'm not mistaken. And I remember thinking at the time this was a conversation which both of you gave Donald Trump a better chance of winning than was the conventional wisdom at the time. I don't know that any of us thought he would win, but I think you all both said it would likely be, you said, I remember Spence particularly, it would be a very close race, you thought. And I remember then a week or two later, Trump had the attack on the parents of Captain Khan, and I thought, oh my God, this conversation is going to be preserved, and we're going to look, you know, ridiculous, because, well, actually, you guys would look ridiculous. I'm just the moderator. And, you know, but actually, it was good. It was an insight to see that Trump had a real chance. So what did you see then, and what do you see looking at the returns, each of you, in terms of what surprised you, what didn't surprise you?
Well, you know, one of the things, obviously the presidency was the big race, but I thought one of the interesting kinds of changes in perspective that has come out of this is the following. No more than a couple of weeks before the election, I think most pundits were prepared to write off the Republican Party, to argue mm-hmm. that it was potentially on a sort of course towards oblivion. A new party might have to emerge, things of this sort, that it wasn't a national party, that the Democrats were going to win the election and be seen as, you know, the true strong party in America going into the balance of both this decade and beyond. Today you see, I think, exactly the opposite. I did a little statistical analysis, and outside of the states of California, New York, and Massachusetts, the Democratic Party won 121 congressional seats. And if you remove the seats that are majority-minority districts from that number, the ones outside of the three states I mentioned, they only won 91 congressional seats in the rest of the country. That combined with controlling only 15 governorships, 15 state houses, and 13, I think, state senates, really changes the their party has become very concentrated in a few places, and I think now they really have, looking forward, a whole different kind of challenge ahead of them. And I think the Republicans, on the other hand, now occupy tremendous strength and an opportunity to really wield that strength to shift direction in a number of major areas.
Yeah, that's interesting. You agree, Jay, or do you see it coming, and how much of it is it real strength, or is this a one-off where Trump wins the Electoral College and loses the popular vote, wins three states by very narrow margins, you can't replicate it again, or anyway, it's a shrinking pool of the electorate? We've all heard these arguments, and that could be true too, I suppose.
Yeah, it could be. I'm not as the more I've, over the years, the more I've done with politics, the less and less I'm interested in racial and ethnic demography. And what really struck me instead in the results was there about a fifth of voters disliked both candidates, thought that, you know, neither was fit to be president, thought they were both dishonest or what have you. And they broke overwhelmingly to Donald Trump, which I think for me more than anything else was a surprise, because especially like you mentioned the Khan thing, I figured that Trump was continuing to do antics like that, and then the Access Hollywood tape. I really thought that these people were going to break to Hillary, the people who disliked both. But maybe it was the Comey thing. Maybe it was, you know, a race to the bottom, the change candidate wins. Because the other thing that really struck me was the right track, wrong track numbers, was that people who thought the country was headed in the wrong direction broke better than 2-1 for Trump. So maybe at the end of the day, the voters, you know, decided to go with the devil they didn't know, as for the sake of change. I think that this is a challenge for the Republican Party, and why, you know, I think there should be some humility in this victory, because even though they dominate, as Spence said, they dominate the House, they dominate the governorships, they dominate the state legislatures, this is not a popular political party. They are unpopular. They are less popular than the Democratic Party nationwide. And I think that that is going to be a challenge for them, for the party collectively, and also for Donald Trump, because he is not popular. He is not well liked among even his own voters. A lot of people had deep concerns about him and voted for him anyway. And so that, to me, is for the Republicans is a real challenge.
Well, what do you think?
Well, I don't think the Republican Party is that unpopular. I think the Democratic Party is unpopular, which is why they didn't win this election, why they haven't been winning elections closer to the voters. And I think the Democrats really have a lot of challenges. I think they found in this campaign that their strategy of running identity campaigns right. is not successful. I think they found that having elites and those who subscribe to political correctness try to dictate to the rest of the country, how they should feel and in effect, criticize and condemn people who didn't feel the right way has hurt them. I think, one of the most telling moments of the campaign in terms of both revealing the inner Hillary Clinton and the attitude of the Democratic Party was the reference to deplorables. Little noted at the end of the election because there was focus on Comey's investigation right. and so on and so forth. But I think that in that one statement, Hillary Clinton spoke for many of the Democratic Party's leadership in enunciating how they feel about the voters they profess to stand with. And I think it is not lost on a large percentage of the electorate. So I know Jay makes this point about, the relative popularity of the parties. There's a historic, Democratic base out there, but I think that it's going to erode further so long as their national party conveys this image of disdain and contempt for the rank and file members.
I agree with Spence's characterization of the Democratic Party. They're not popular by any stretch, and I would point out the real irony of this election, because it was 8 years ago during the Democratic Party primary that Obama won this huge opening through on Super Tuesday, but then Hillary Clinton came charging back through the industrial Midwest and the border South, rallying the white working class right. and rallying the voters who Obama had disdained as bitter clingers in places like West Virginia and Kentucky. And she turned it all around in Ohio, of all places, and then went and turned it around in Pennsylvania. And, so she, better than anybody else in that party, should have appreciated the limits of the Obama coalition. And she should have appreciated that when Obama was elected in the general election in 2008 and 2012, yes, of course, his victory was driven by a large African-American turnout and millennials and upscale social liberals and all this stuff. But he won Ohio, he won Michigan, he won Iowa, he won Wisconsin, he won Madison, Wisconsin, but he also won rural Wisconsin. And these are all places that abandoned Hillary Clinton last week. And she, of all people, should have seen that coming.
It is interesting why she didn't. I mean, Bill Clinton apparently tried hard to remind his wife's campaign that, whites vote, not just working class whites vote. And you're going to lose them, probably, but it makes a big difference if you lose them 60-40 or 70-30 or 75-25, right? And it just didn't seem that Hillary Clinton had any strategy to reach out to them.
Yeah, you'll have this feeling that both in the mainstream media and in the Hillary Clinton campaign and the Democratic National Headquarters, nobody talks to anybody that doesn't agree with them.
Right.
And they believe each other and reinforce each other's prejudices about the voters and about who's going to win, et cetera, et cetera. It used to be, I can remember not that long ago, that national political reporters would actually go to bellwether precincts and walk around and knock on doors and talk to voters and try to at least make some effort at understanding what people were thinking. None of that seems to happen. Many people cover the campaign from their living room remotely based on, what's on cable news stations right. and polling data. They only talk to people like themselves who, are all of the same mind about the candidates and what's contemptible and what's good and so on and so forth. And I think they were totally out of touch. And I don't know what Bill Clinton's messages were to his campaign team, but I think they were viewed as I think he was viewed as out of touch.
Yeah,
anachronistic.
Right.
Guy who had a feel for winning in the 90s, but nothing, no way to no feel for winning in the era of social media, et cetera, et cetera. Turns out he was probably right.
And the National Press Corps that was traveling with the Trump campaign, if you were following them on Twitter, you would see, and first of all, a lot of them are young. They're kids. Because it's not a great gig. I mean, you got to travel with the political campaign. But they spent a large portion of their time mocking the people at the Trump rallies or just being horrified that these people could hate the media as much as they do, or focusing on the most extreme person at the rally, or emphasizing the most extreme, uncharitable opinions that these people possess, where it was very disdainful. That was a real vibe that I got from it. And you could pick this up on Twitter, because, when they're filing their reports, everything sort of, they're feelings and their kind of political ideology all get sort of evened out by their news editor. But on Twitter, it's like this instant kind of feedback as it's happening. And I was really struck at how little the National Press Corps thinks of the Trump voters. And even now, you see them trying to like hang the stigma of racism on Trump voters, as if to vote for Trump you had to agree with everything that he said. And by the way, they never say that about Hillary Clinton voters, and they're they all think classified information should be held on homebrew servers. I mean, you could vote for Hillary Clinton and think that she made a mistake, but apparently if you voted for Donald Trump in this alternate universe, you have to be a racist, a misogynist, a bigot, as opposed to somebody who's just had enough and willing to try change.
So what about, let's talk about both parties politically for a minute, and then I want to talk about the actual challenges right now of governing. And you were a senator, you've really been through this, and Jay studied this. But on the political side, so the sophisticated, I think, and not ridiculous argument against being as optimistic about the Republican future as you sounded at the beginning, Spence, is the number of non-college educated voters is declining every 4 years. The number of white voters is declining every 4 years. So just as a analytical, matter, the Democrats' strengths are in growing portions of the electorate. The Republican strength is in a shrinking portion of the electorate. It's a very big portion of the electorate, white working class. And actually, Trump won white college educated, too, so it's a little misleading what they say. But nonetheless, he's sort of squeezed out a victory narrowly from this electorate, which is declining. It's sort of, this is Pete Wilson in 1994 in California. Yes, he sort of was able to run against immigration. He won one last time. And since then, the place has been a graveyard for Republicans, basically. And I mean, is that too deterministic? Is it false? is it true that Republicans have to adjust some?
I think if the Democratic Party strategy is to elect Keith Ellison as their national chairman and then sit back and wait for demographics to do it for them, as a Republican, I'd be delighted.
Yeah, they do put lot of weight on demographic inevitability.
Yeah.
As if working class Hispanics couldn't have the same concerns.
I mean, the only thing better for the Republicans than Keith Ellison becoming DNC chair is for Anthony Weiner to get a reality TV show. I mean, these are the two, the two prayers are answered sort of Republican wishes. But here's the thing. We always look at these demographics and make the assumption that the relative strength within the demographics will stay what it is.
Right.
But I think the Democratic Party right now is behaving in a way that is forcing ever larger numbers of white voters to vote Republican. So even if the white percentage of the electorate becomes smaller, the Democrats are driving more and more white voters into the Republican camp through the identity politics that I don't think is very effective for them. And I think they're driving even larger quantities of male white voters into the Republican ranks, and maybe irreversibly so. So it's hard to tell. I'm not prophesizing that will happen. I'm just saying I think you can look at which parts of the electorate are growing and shrinking and make these adjustments. But younger voters, as they begin to earn more money and pay more taxes don't stay the same political right. philosophy in the same party that they were the first time they voted. And the same happens for others as well. So I think that's up for grabs. But I do think the Republicans have a pretty strong position now. They're not concentrated in three or four states and have majorities in many states.
There's a great book, and it really is a good book. It's called The Emerging Democratic Majority. I disagree with a lot of it, but it was very intelligent. Well-written book by Rui Teixeira, who I believe is at the Center for American Progress, and John Judas, who's formerly of the New Republic. It was written about 14 years ago. But, it's almost become kind of a Democratic Bible,
right.
Which I think is unfortunate for them, because I think as insightful as that book is, it is based on a false premise, which is an emerging majority. Majorities are not... They do not emerge. They are forged by politicians, and then they are maintained by careful and crafty political leadership. So, for instance, if you look at like Abraham Lincoln, when was the realignment in that decade? Was it in 1860, or was it in 1861 and 62 and 63 as Lincoln laid the moral foundation for the argument against slavery? Similar with FDR. FDR in 1932 won the whole country, but with the exception of Maine and Vermont of all places. And from that, though, he forged a majority that he was able to maintain and hold on to of Southern segregationists, ethnic voters, Catholics, populist Democrats in the West. And he did that. It wasn't handed to him. He did it through public policy and through the actual act of governance. And this is what I think that the Democrats in the Obama era have misunderstood, that majorities are not handed to them. Opportunities to create and forge and sustain majorities are handed to them, which they then have to go and actually do through the act of governance. And this is why I think that Obama was elected comfortably in 2008 and then again in 2012, because the country likes him personally. But if you look at the down ballot for the Democratic Party, has been a disaster for them, because I think on that governing level, I think that the Democratic Party was given an epic opportunity in 2009 that it blew.
Yeah. I mean, one way to think about it is, if Obamacare had worked, Hillary Clinton would be the president-elect, right? I mean, I do think those premiums going up 2 weeks before the election probably moved the necessary number of votes. It was an emblem. It was Obama's major domestic policy initiative. It was an emblem of kind of big government liberalism that was supposed to help people who needed help with health insurance, and it ended up...
And if the economy had grown the way that they had estimated when they passed that stimulus,
right.
I mean, that's something that Democrats like to tout the length of this expansion, but it is the weakest expansion in post-war history. I mean, my goodness, the Federal Reserve has barely touched interest rates in a decade.
Well, so let's talk about governing, because I do think ultimately that's what, obviously, I mean, all these instant analyses after the election, Trump with Reagan, and of course the Reagan Revolution wasn't 1980. 1980 was the opportunity, which he then won the Cold War and got the economy going again, and 84 and 88 were the consequences of that, and ultimately in 1994 probably the Republican victory
right.
in Congress and so forth. So very much the point both of you are making. So what right now, I mean, where does Trump stand? Where does the Republican Party stand? Where does the Democratic Party stand in terms of challenges, opportunities? Spence, you've been there. You've been there in the Senate when Clinton won re-election. You watched Bush win election for the first time, and you became a member of his cabinet. What would you be telling Donald Trump? Maybe you are telling him privately, but you can tell it publicly. tell it to the rest of us.
Well, I think right now probably members of the Senate who don't know Donald Trump well are straining to figure out how to close that familiarity gap. I'm sure Senator Jeff Sessions, who's clearly his closest ally in the Senate, probably poised to be the Paul Laxalt of the Donald Trump presidency, has found himself being...
If he stays in the Senate.
Yeah, being closely befriended in a way he hadn't
right.
previously been, because everybody's got a list of things they've been hoping they could get done and are now going to try to figure out how they can reconcile that with the things Trump wants to get done. It's a little different because, unlike the traditional presidential candidates who have a long record of public service and policy positions, Trump's obviously a little less of a known commodity. I mean, in his campaign was not always that specific about the directions that he was going to go. But I do think there's probably a lot of expectation. Certainly there is in the House. We hear that from a number of sources that the House Republicans think they're going to really be setting the agenda and they're going to be passing things quickly and teeing them up for the Senate. I'm sure Mitch McConnell's anxious to get his crack at it as well. But I think they'll have to be a little bit of a resolution of differences here between Trump, the candidate, and Trump, the president-elect, because obviously his relationships with many of the members weren't all that warm and cordial.
But who do you think who's in command? Do you agree with the notion that this is, for now, at least Trump's party? When you're a president-elect who wins the office from the opposing party and you hold the majorities in both houses, and you get some credit for doing so, which I think Trump will get some credit for, even if you can say, well, some of the senators ran ahead of Trump and all, but it still seems to me, given what people expected, doesn't Trump have a strong hand?
Yes, he does. And, it's not the only time. I mean, in 2000, George W. Bush won the presidency like Trump with a losing the popular vote and running behind a lot of his party's Senate candidates that were on the ballot that year, both in states he carried and ones he didn't. Trump does have right now that momentum in his corner. And, people tend to underestimate as you form a cabinet, as you begin your transition period and so on, all of these members who may have at one point or another had a ill word to say about Trump, et cetera, will now be anxious to be working with him to have their various political allies selected for appointments or for the judiciary, et cetera. So I think, yes, he's going to, if he takes advantage of it, have his moment here.
Any particular thing he should do very early first? How do you build the capital? I think that's very important to win some victories.
Well, I think he's got, there's a lot of things. I think he needs to take bold action. I think he needs to hit the ground running. I think he has to work now to not be defined by the media because that's already kind of begun. And he needs to, I think, generate, and hopefully Reince Priebus and some of the Republican Party leaders can now all get together on the same page and perhaps go to some of the billionaires who supported other candidates and give them a chance for atonement here by helping to put a positive support campaign behind Trump's initiatives and his actions. I think, second, he needs to, he can move in a lot of areas fairly quickly. The Keystone Pipeline in the energy sector, perhaps something with regard to the Iran nuclear deal in the international and national security sectors. I personally think he should move in the same period he's announcing his cabinet to announce his recommendation for the Supreme Court and get that Supreme Court nomination out there.
So a nomination that he wouldn't, of course, formally submit till January 20th. Obviously, he's only president-elect. But say it now. I mean, announce it now so the vetting can begin, and so it becomes a very early fight. You think it's a good fight for Trump to have?
I think it is. I think he needs to pick somebody that will cause conservatives to feel that they picked the right guy, that he meant what he said. And at the same time, I think having that battle go on Capitol Hill will suck up much of the energy and oxygen, as they say, from the left. As they will get very invested in that fight. And as they fight that fight, it will give Trump, I think, and the Republicans a chance both to secure the confirmation of the cabinet and a lot of the early legislative activity because they can be moving on two tracks at once. And the Supreme Court's going to, I think, occupy so much of the left's attention, it will give Trump a chance to move his agenda quickly and to get his confirmations for other key positions.
I hadn't thought about that sort of distracting the left. And I guess that's a tough vote against, assuming it's a distinguished nominee, a sitting judge,
right,
or, a senator conceivably, someone who's on that list who's been vetted before. It's a tough vote against the new president who's won with an opening on the court for a senator, a Democratic senator from a state that Trump has carried in a big way. And there are several such Democratic senators,
right?
Some of whom were on the ballot in
2018.
In Tester in Montana and Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota, and there are others, obviously. That would be
Indiana, Donnelly.
Forcing that fight early. That's interesting. Jay, what do you think?
Well, look, I think so. The political context that Trump faces here is that he's a minority president, right? He was elected with about 47% of the vote. Hillary Clinton won more votes. Importantly, in states totaling 270 electoral votes, he won less than half of the vote. So that creates a political problem for him. It's not one that is that it admits of solutions, but it has to be recognized for what it is. And so I think that there are two examples through history that really stand out from presidents who were elected in similar circumstances. First was Benjamin Harrison in 1888. Harrison lost the popular vote to Grover Cleveland, but had won the state of New York and so was a minority president. And Harrison and the Republican majority, because this was also the first time the Republicans had complete control of government for over a decade, so they used this as an opportunity to pass everything that was on their bucket list, so to speak, regardless of whether it was popular or not. So for instance, a couple years prior, President Grover Cleveland had been calling for tariff reform, which was well overdue. The Republicans managed to stop that and then turned around and passed a McKinley tariff, which increased rates further. Now, Harrison lost in 1892 to Grover Cleveland. Mm-hmm. So that's the first path. The second path, though, is George W. Bush in 2000 was faced with a similar situation in that he won about 47% of the vote and didn't win a majority in many states. And George W. Bush, I think, was very smart in recognizing that the vote that, you know, that so Gore got 47.5, he got 47, so it was really a race to sort of, you know, he had to grow his coalition, so he had to figure out how to do that. And if you look at his domestic policy, particularly before 9/11, his domestic policy was targeted to grow his political coalition. He did the Medicare prescription drugs. He did
That was later. No, that was later.
But that was part of his. That was on his agenda. He was interested in doing that. He did
No Child Left
Behind.
He
did
a tax cut.
Faith-based initiatives, a tax cut, across the board tax cut. And importantly, on a lot of these issue items, he was able to rope in Democrats, not obviously a very large number of Democrats, but did get, you know, Democratic senators to vote for his agenda. Now, does that mean that Trump has to work across the aisle? No, not necessarily. What Trump, I think, needs to do is not necessarily follow George W. Bush's strategy, but to recognize that he has to formulate his own strategy. And he has to recognize that he does not have a majority coalition, that there is a really good chance that the Democrats can poach. They don't have to swing very many voters, like 100,000 votes across the entire country. But Trump has the advantage now that he is the president. He can work to build that coalition. And I think that should be his political priority.
I would say that's not the people I've talked to. They're not quite thinking that way. I think they think victory is victory. If you can pass stuff that works out or well, you can get some Democratic votes too. But I think they'll go for a quick reconciliation, do the big tax reform, which some Democrats might vote for. But if they stick on reconciliation with the repeal of Obamacare, I suppose the Democrats won't vote for it. I don't know. They can put the Democrats in a tough position.
That's what the Republicans did in 1889. That's exactly what they did. And it was called the Democrats, made a lot of political hay, deriding it as the $1 billion Congress, which sounds quaint nowadays because $1 billion is like a rounding error. But the point is that, you know, the Republicans back then failed to appreciate the extent to which the country was evenly divided, maybe not deeply divided, and just passed everything that they could get through and jammed it through.
But this wouldn't be a Republican agenda, it would be a Trump agenda. Right. If you did Medicare cuts on that, that would be a mistake. I don't think Trump has any interest in doing that. And that's going to be one of the interesting things, isn't it, Spence? I mean, the degree to which Trump's agenda is not going to look like, I think Paul Ryan and those guys are kidding themselves if they think Trump's election lets the Republican House pass the much more traditional, I'm sympathetic to it as a policy matter, but the much more traditional Republican entitlement reform type agenda. I think Trump will pass a Trumpian agenda.
I think that's where they'll end up. I think they may think that's the direction they're going to start. I think that they'll find that Trump isn't going to go along with all of it. I also have to say that, well, I'm not you know, Jay, I'm not all that. If I were Trump's, advisors, I would not be telling him that he needed to broaden his coalition right now. He's gone from a coalition of very small number of Americans to winning the presidency. And the one thing that he has going for him is that even among Democrats who didn't vote for him is a tremendous anti-Washington sentiment. And that's where I think he builds his coalition, by taking action that shows that Washington isn't going to run the way people, you know, have seen it run, that it's going to be different. And I think he's got to do what he thinks, what he's talked about. He's got to deliver on some of these things. He doesn't have to deliver on all of it, but he's got to show that he was sincere. And I think he's going to find a lot of people who will join him in that effort. I think failure to do that and waiting too long to move will put him in greater jeopardy than taking action soon. And he has 4 years. He may hurt some Republicans who run in 2 years, who might have had a chance to win Senate seats if Hillary Clinton had been elected president. But theoretically, at least, 4 years gives him a lot of time to get the economy strengthened, to get some of these key matters we've talked about passed, and I think people will reward him for that.
I mean, it seems to me he can do Obamacare repeal and buy a couple of years for transition and grandfathering, and so he doesn't have to resolve all the issues of replace. I mean, I was running in my head. I was not a Trump supporter, so I was running in my head through all the things he can get passed rather easily, either on a party vote, because the whole party is for repealing Obamacare, or on a bipartisan vote, infrastructure. What if he comes up with an ethics package? No one can, you know, lobby. I mean, a much stricter version of even what exists now. I mean, they could just, you know, year, 5 years, you can't, after you're a senator, you're barred forever from lobbying the Senate. If you work in the administrative branch, you can't do this. I mean, that would be a tough thing for Democrats to, you know,
To say no to.
You can imagine him coming, the judicial appointments, especially if he's careful not to, you know, to pick people who've been maybe confirmed before and stuff. There are a lot of ways he could create tough vote, but, you know, and I think you're right, don't you think the momentum early could be pretty impressive? I mean, that seems like that's important to win. That's the one thing I learned when I was in the White House. I mean, you want to win early votes when you're elected or reelected.
And he also has within his power to reverse a lot of the executive orders.
Well, that's true.
That were signed by Obama, many of them considered dubious acts of presidential authority. And I think undoing these kinds of things, for instance, in some of the areas that relate to immigration, it will take some of the pressure off the kind of broader immigration agenda that he talked about various times, you know, so that doesn't have to happen as soon. It gives him time to, you know, to figure out where there really can be action in that area. So I think he needs to, those are the things people are going to want to see, an action taken early and direct, you know, and very definitively. And then we'll, you know, at that point we'll, you know, he'll have, you know, he'll be under attack, but he's going to be under attack no matter what.
The must-do areas he needs to do something in or begin doing something in with the prospect of doing more in, I guess, are trade. He needs to start renegotiating stuff at least, and maybe do something unilaterally on, you know, China and currency or whatever. Immigration, I suppose, he needs to at least do some things while saying that other things can wait and will require working with Congress. What are the other sort of signature? Obamacare repeal and replace.
Right.
And I think a pro-growth tax and regulatory measures, right? I mean, if he could get those four tracks going at once, that'd be a pretty strong first quarter or two of his presidency, I guess. I don't know that he has to worry about, I mean, that a lot of other things will happen.
I think to get back to something that you mentioned earlier about, you know, the Trump, this is going to be an interesting dynamic to see Trump in this Republican Congress, because I think there are two things that really stand out to me. The first is that this is a Congress, a Republican majority, that is chock full of really sterling members. Smart people, really smart, obviously Paul Ryan, but people like Jeb Hensarling, Marco Rubio, you know, Tom Cotton, Rand Paul, Ted Cruz. I mean, in both chambers, you have up and down the line, you have a lot of really talented policymakers and very talented politicians. And I think that And a lot of them, I think, are going to be interested in reasserting Congress's role as the first branch, as the Article I branch. I think there's, and I think that that's an implied premise of Ryan's sort of agenda, right? So that's the first thing that's really interesting and related to
the fact that plausible?
Trump, that, well, what I think is interesting is that Trump is not from this world. Trump is not on, he doesn't come from these people.
Right.
He doesn't come from the same places that these people come from. He is from a different place. So I'm not sure how that's going to work itself out in practice, but, you know, I think that the top line stuff right off the bat, you know, those big four things we talked about, you know, I think there's going to be agreement on that. And especially, I think the House Republicans will have the advantage because they already have all these ideas sort of laid out. So here, Mr. President, you can take these.
I don't agree with that. I just think, maybe I'm wrong. I mean, look, I would personally prefer that. I mean, I'm closer to them on most of these issues. I just think the dynamic of a newly elected president, I think he's just going to say, I want this, this, and this, and not that, that, and that. Maybe Paul Ryan says, I'm sorry, Mr. President, we're a co-equal branch. I've got my committee chairman here, and they're going to work on their own tax bill markup. But maybe I'm kidding myself because I've only worked in the executive branch, you know. But I guess I think when he says, I want these three things, of course he'll give Congress some things, but I think he's in a very dominant bargaining position. Maybe I'm, despite being a minority president and all that, maybe I'm wrong. That'll be a very interesting dynamic.
I think, well, that's.
And I guess a lot depends on how he comports himself as president-elect.
I think that as a Congress, I mean, from an institutional perspective, Congress is as stocked with talent as it's been as in any point that I can remember. So if there is going to be sort of an intra-party, inter-branch battle, this is the recipe for it.
Yeah, it'd be interesting.
Yeah, I don't so much see that happening, though. I mean, they may be talented, and I give them all of that, but at the end of the day, they want to get stuff done. And I think if he starts undoing the executive orders, which they feel bypass them, he will have made a statement that demonstrates that he has, you know, respect for that institution on the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue. And, you know, no president that I'm aware of came to office with a party, with his own party in control, and then sat back and was forced to take a subordinate role to the Congress's agenda setting. I mean, maybe it won't be, you know, all set at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, but it's not going to be all set in the other end. And they'll have to work this out. He is a different type of political figure. But I think I really can't see, at least in the early stages. I sort of agree with you, Bill. I think there's, you know, there's going to be not deference exactly, but the goal of getting this stuff done. And these guys aren't going to, I mean, what good is it to them if they, you know, they say, oh, we've been waiting to pass the Public Utility Holding Corporation Act for years and we couldn't get enough votes, but now we do. And Trump says, that isn't on my agenda, but I am with you on Obamacare. They'll say, fine, we'll do Obamacare. I mean, there's plenty to get done.
That's interesting.
Historically speaking, I mean, if you go back, the thought that I've had in my head is the 1840s and the Whigs. Is that the Whigs, you know, they borrowed the Andrew Jackson model to win, for William Henry Harrison to win. But the idea behind it was that Harrison would be Henry Clay's puppet. And then Harrison, of course, died, and then John Taylor was Tyler became president, and there was real conflict. And then the same thing happened 8 years later with Zachary Taylor. It was the same basic idea. I mean, if there's any president who was elected in political history who looks most like Trump, it would be Zachary Taylor. And there was enormous conflict between Taylor and the congressional Whigs. And the only reason the Compromise of 1850 was ultimately approved was because Taylor died. Taylor was set to veto it, and then Taylor died. And Millard Fillmore, who was, if there's a historical parallel to Millard Fillmore, it would probably be Mike Pence. So this is not, and one of the similarities between the two periods is how stocked the congressional Whigs were. I mean, you had Henry Clay and you had Daniel Webster in the same chamber at the same time.
Yeah, but there's so much stronger a president. It seems to me, I don't know.
Yeah, remember, at the same time, this was coming in the wake of Andrew Jackson's presidency, which was a very powerful presidency. It was really, you know, the first example of the imperial presidency. And Clay overly clever as he always was, they thought that they had a workaround around it. I'm not making any predictions. I'm just pointing out that the potential for inter-branch conflict, even though we're operating, because usually we see conflict between the two branches being a partisan conflict, you know, but it's not. That's not the case for all of history.
That would be
yeah. But on the other hand, I mean, you could, you know, I mean, we can go back, 170 years, but we could also go back to 1980, and we could say that there's a lot of commonality between the way Donald Trump emerged to become president and the way Ronald Reagan did, and we can say that, you know, Ronald Reagan came to Washington, and how many people on Capitol Hill thought they would get the better of this guy who. Yeah. Didn't have a lot of background in Washington, you know, was viewed in many quarters here in Washington as sort of naive, you know, sort of simplistic in his thinking, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And we'll show him, you know, we'll take care of him, you know, because we, you know, we're more expert than he is. And at the end of the day, the people, you know, tend to not be as enamored with individual members of Congress, the House and Senate, as they are with the president. And for whatever reason, Ronald Reagan managed to have the upper hand for the most part. And certainly during the initial, 2 years of his presidency. So it could go that way, too. I mean, I don't think any of us know enough about how Donald Trump will stack his administration, stack his administration. We don't know, you know, whether he'll feel that he's now been elected and can work with Congress and not risk being seen as having become part of the problem. But that's assuming he addresses some of those things the right way. I think he can have a pretty strong hand here for a while.
Thinking about the discussion so far, I have a question now to ask both of you that I hope will be interesting. I'd really like to get your thoughts on it. I'm struck thinking about our own discussion here. This is a week after the election. I've already been on, you've all been on to a couple of panels at least, and read so much more about the discussion. And most analyses and discussions have been focused on voting groups or demography. We talked about that a little before, or the economy, you know, what effect would renegotiating trade deals have. But what strikes me about our discussion, and I think this, I find this very congenial, but I think you as a practitioner in politics and you as a student of political history, how much we've sort of not focused on that in a sense, and focused on the contingencies of politics. You know, a lot depends on what individuals do and the people, whether they're senators or certainly in the case of Trump, and we'll talk more about the Democrats in the case of their possible leaders. And so I guess I'm curious about that. I mean, how much do you think is sort of baked in the cake, so to speak, for the next 4 years based on economic trends, social, cultural trends, you know, demographic trends, and how much do you think it depends, each of you, on particular individuals, decisions, luck, chance, exogenous events, and I guess which individuals in particular? I mean, how much do you think things are kind of predictable, and how much do you think it's in?
Well,
does that make sense as a question?
It's a hard question.
Yeah,
really.
but we can be more specific.
The one thing I would just say is this: yeah. I had said in countless conversations and maybe in appearances like this for some months that the high level of unpopularity that Trump and Clinton were registering meant that it was almost certain either one, if they won, would be a one-term president. And I think the Democrats are going to be making that presumption as well. And that may well be the case. If something's baked in the cake, it's that a very unpopular person who gets elected just because the other person's equivalently unpopular, stands a very rough road getting reelected.
With a minority of the popular vote and with a lot of real challenges out there, you could even compound your points and make it even stronger.
And in the case of Trump, obviously, with a lack of experience in Washington that could make it difficult to accomplish some of the things he wants, not because he doesn't try, but because he doesn't have the right toolkit to get started with. I maybe he'll just do fine, but he's under, you know, he's going to be under, I think, a lot of pressure to try to address that. I mean, Jay talked about him being a minority president. It's not just that he's a minority president; he's also a minority president with a very high unfavorable rating. I don't know what the numbers will look like on inaugural day, but typically, even presidents who aren't terribly popular on the day of their election or who are barely more popular at that time, by the time they actually assume office, at least are kind of given a fair chance by the voters. I think it's not unlikely that Trump won't find himself with his favorable, unfavorable rating above water at that point. And I think the media's characterizations of him already and some of his initial actions suggest that he's not only not going to have a honeymoon, he's going to be under the gun.
The opposite of honeymoon.
Yeah, the opposite of honeymoon. So that's going to make, I think the thing that's, if there's something baked in the cake, it's that a president is going to take office with a very high negative rating and have a real challenge to turn some of that around. I think he can do it because he also has the fact that, you know, people's expectations of what he can do are pretty low. And I think if he demonstrates capacity and fitness, he can make some headway. But obviously, that's gonna be the challenge he faces.
It seems to me, Jay, your kind of political science, if I can characterize it, tends not to be deterministic, I think, and mm-hmm. That you respect the role of institutions and history and all that. And I mean, do you agree with my sense that let's put it this way, the spectrum of outcomes of the next 4 years, let's say, is unbelievably large? I mean, I guess it always is to some degree, but often you can kind of predict, right, given the nature of the world and the nature of the parties, maybe where things might be 2 or 4 or 8 years from now. Whereas here, it just seems to me you could have, you know, Trump triumphant, you could have Trump collapsing and, you know, total fiasco in his first term, you could have the Republican Party still, despite Trump's victory, splitting and, you know, we're in real civil war, you could have the Democratic Party in civil war, you could have three parties conceivably. Am I wrong about this?
No,
is this an unusual moment in that way? Do people always think that? And then, of course, really, history works out in a much more predictable way.
If we're just going to go off of the historical trend, the historical trend is that for over 100 years, you know, when a party enters the White House after having been a minority party, it almost always is reelected. It almost always gets a second term. The one exception to that was Jimmy Carter in 1980. So that Trump has that going for him. But on the other hand, you know, Trump is also inheriting an economy that is getting a growth cycle that's a little long in the tooth now, and hasn't really generated a lot of wealth for middle America. So when the economy turns, who knows what's going to happen? So I think those sort of forces, maybe they cancel each other out. But I think the real uncertainty here is, you know, is Trump himself. I was sort of reminded of Machiavelli, right? Machiavelli's argument was is that, you know, great statesmen are in possession of virtù and master fortuna, which is a fickle goddess, but that, you know, but take the bull by the horns. And I think that there's this tendency among, I was certainly guilty of it, of underestimating Trump and underestimating his virtù and sort of like, well, he's going to screw up. He'll screw this up. He'll screw that up. He didn't. He won. None of us thought he would win. And he won in surprising ways. He broke a lot of the rules that we all thought you couldn't break and win. And he broke them all in one. So who knows? I think that, I mean, because it's not just like, you know, George W. Bush in 2000 was similarly situated in that he was a minority president, inheriting an economy that was just about to slide into recession. But he was a very conventional Republican. I mean, he was George Bush, you know. Donald Trump is very unconventional. And his unconventionality has not been a problem for him. I mean, he's going to be the president.
That's been a problem, but also he overcame the problematic parts of it.
Well, the other thing, too, is that, you know, well, social media has obviously had a, you know, a longevity here that predates Trump's election, just as television had existed before John F. Kennedy's.
Right.
It's arguably the case that Trump is the first president of the social media generation. And that also, I think, is something that you know, could have a profound impact.
Yeah,
on
talk
how
about
things...
that. So I'm interested by that. And people I know who are smart kind of cultural observers really think that's been underestimated, that we've had the first real...
Yeah.
It's a real breakthrough. I mean, the massive television advertising doesn't seem to have moved a lot of votes.
Right, and I think...
spent 3-1. The Twitter account turned out to have more effect, you know, and so forth.
Yeah, and I think, you know, for the many people who as a profession, engage in political organizational work and get out the vote work and all of these sorts of things, which we were told all year was going to be the ultimate secret weapon in the Democrat arsenal. It didn't really work either. I mean, and so I think
just on that point, if I can just interrupt, I think Jay and I were very much in the same boat on this. Yeah, that's why people like us thought, you know, if the polls are Hillary plus one or two, she'll win by 3 or 4, just because surely this, the get out the vote gives her a point, doesn't give her a huge amount, but you know, so the fact that Trump outperformed the guy with no get out the vote effort right. outperformed the polls. That's a little startling.
Well, I think that's, you know, I think this is all a function of two or three things that the media did not focus on at all. First, early voting has changed get out the vote.
Yes.
And it changed it a lot. I mean, there was a time when everybody more or less voted on election day, and get out the vote meant going and finding people who got up that day and either were busy or they were incapacitated or in some way or another unlikely to get to the polls, and they had been identified and people hectored them until they right. got either into a bus or a car or their own vehicle or whatever and voted. That's all done, you know, that's done now. I mean, in almost every jurisdiction, there's a million different intermediate steps you can take to right. vote. And so this election day effort is a far, I think, a far less relevant factor in terms of moving numbers, because those, you know, the parties get their absentee ballots out, the people vote in varieties of ways. And so I think that's overrated. And I think television ads are overrated. I mean, we are going through a profound change in how political communications are work and what constitutes effective political communication. Sorry to say that, you know, the traditional sources of news and information have no longer got as much clout, and that the National Enquirer perhaps has more clout. Right. All of these are changes that are going on. And so, again, I think it does shuffle the deck for the future, not just for presidential campaigns or Donald Trump, but I think we're going to be in a different era over the next decade as this transition picks up steam.
Go ahead, Jay.
Yeah, I think that your question is a very interesting one about social media. I mean, historically speaking, the rise of television was what really gave, and before that, radio, really gave the president an institutional edge over the Congress, because the presidency, the executive branch, by design, speaks with one voice. It's the president. The Congress, on the other hand, is a multiplicity of voices, so you cannot have Congress speak. But, you know, and this was, you know, FDR and his fireside chats was a milestone, and then television. But, you know, in recent years, though, the networks have sort of begun to use the president for their own purposes. So the president wants to speak, but then the networks get to decide whether or not it's newsworthy. And then suddenly the president is constrained to getting out his message. And what is interesting about social media is that it's not, it's almost the wrong word to use the word media. It's almost the wrong word to use, because the mainstream media actually serves as a mediator right. between the president and the people. Whereas social media, there is nobody right. there. And I think that Obama was really one of the first to try and use that to his own purposes, where he would do interviews with goofy YouTube people and things like that. And he had an Instagram account and a Twitter account, but I don't really feel like Obama's use of social media was not nearly as effective as Trump's, which I think is what to me is really interesting, is that Trump is the first president to use social media in a new, interesting, provocative, and I think politically successful way. So, like, you know, for instance, Obama has a Twitter account that has however many millions of people, but the tweets are all written by his staff, and it's all looked over. It's very conventional, very boring, you know. You know, and also more than that, you know, Trump, you know, Obama would go on Jimmy Fallon and do a goofy bit, but Nixon did that in the 60s, you know, on Laugh-In. You know, Trump did something different where he himself spoke directly to his followers.
I thought it was interesting. I groaned like everyone else, I suppose, who's older and conventional, when he, after Wednesday, after his acceptance speech, very early Wednesday morning, and then his visit to the White House Thursday, both of which I think he conducted very in a dignified way, in a traditional way, and so forth. And I thought, okay, you know, Trump's kind of learning the rules of the game. And then I think it was the next morning, I can't remember, Friday morning, when suddenly he was tweeting again. Yep. And my initial response, and it wasn't, I think, totally ridiculous, was, oh, God, he's president of the United States. He shouldn't be doing this. But I wonder whether he was smarter than I was. I mean, he understands that going forward, he has a way to communicate directly and in a non-quote presidential way that is very number of his supporters really relish. And now, whether it's 51% of the public is a different question, but he doesn't have to, as long as he doesn't antagonize other people, it's a very useful way for him to do that, I think.
And to get back to what we were talking about earlier in sort of Trump's political skill set, you know, nobody in the history of the Western world has been as adroit in managing his own personal brand as Donald Trump, which is really what a president who's just been elected and is looking to get reelected, I mean, that's really what they need to do. They need to manage their personal brand. And so, you know, if Trump's instincts are telling him to go out and tweet, you know, I mean, his instincts about how to keep his name on the tip of everybody's tongue is pretty gosh darn good. So,
you know, and Kennedy was elected at the dawn of, you know, the role of television becoming much more the major source of political and news communication. And so then he had televised news conferences, which was considered, you know, kind of revolutionary. And he had a pretty high approval rating because people thought they got to know the president through these various...
Even though objectively he had a very rocky first...
Yeah.
2 or 3 years
in
foreign policy and domestic policy and so forth.
Yeah. And his wife did a tour of the White House on television, and they found ways to use this new mechanism for communicating with people that allowed there to be this kind of personal connection. And now we've entered into an era in which there's a new way to establish a personal connection, and Trump may be the first, and there'll be probably people who come along that are more effective at it, or they'll develop better ways to do it. But at the moment, at least, it could well be the difference between voters feeling that they're, you know, remote from the White House in Washington and feeling connected and that they have an advocate there. And there definitely are members of Congress who have utilized Facebook and their Twitter accounts to strongly reinforce their popularity in districts that people didn't expect them to hold, but because they had this personal connection with the electorate, they've been doing it, and I think we shouldn't doubt it.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Trump could do the same.
I mean, results probably matter ultimately the most, but you can buy yourself time at least and goodwill, I suppose. I mean, that does raise another question, which is one reason I have the instinct that, again, we're in such uncharted waters that we're underestimating. People in Washington are underestimating the kinds of changes that are about to come. Is that what has even our discussion here has been a little bit, well, Trump, that was a kind of a weird guy to run, and he won in an unusual way. And then, you know, one assumes we get back to the same kinds of people running in 2018 and the same rules of the game in 2020. But really, is that correct? I mean, why won't there be other Trump? I mean, is Trump that unique? I mean, he is an unusual guy and talented in some ways and had a huge brand already and a celebrity. But don't an awful lot of people around the country think, well, why exactly do I have to step aside and let the congressman step up for the Senate seat in 2018? Why don't I just run, you know, if I'm wealthy or if I have wealthy people backing me? And do I run even in a party primary? Maybe I just run as an independent. Because Trump, though he happened to run as a Republican, in some way the theory of Trump would be translatable to a third-party candidacy, I would say. I mean, don't you think more things could happen in 2018 or 2020 than we think?
The point you're really, I think, making is that the barriers to entry at all levels of politics may now be a lot lower.
Yeah.
There was this sort of sanction process that always existed where if you wanted to be the congressman, you had to go around and see all the opinion leaders in your district and cultivate a donor group and this and that and the other thing. Or for president, you had to go and, you know, meet every county chairman in Iowa. And I mean, it may be that that's changing and that other people can circumvent that process in the world we're in, especially with the super PAC possibilities, and because there are these ways of reaching voters that aren't as expensive. So that could happen.
I mean, I was thinking of Hillary Clinton. On the one hand, that was new, that you take advantage of having been First Lady, and in her case, a very high-profile First Lady, and in her case, a First Lady who was a victim of her husband, so there was sympathy for her, and you go to another state that you've never lived in, really, but it's a state that's congenial to you and that is used to having carpetbaggers. New York's a little different. And so you run for Senate. And I remember at the time thinking, this is kind of a bad thing for our politics, because this is just, I mean, in the old days, there's some reason why you want, like, people who lived in New York to be the senator from New York and so forth. And you don't want just first ladies deciding they get to become senators in this slightly third world way. Having said that, looked at it from 2016, that was really old-fashioned. She was first lady, and she thought, well, I better be a senator, because right. that's the necessary credential to actually run for president. Then in 2008, having run and lost, she was asked by President Obama to become Secretary of State, and in an old-fashioned way, she thought, well, I want to run, I assume she thought already, I want to run in 2016. So having been Secretary of State for 4 years would be an excellent additional credential. And of course, it almost got her there. One shouldn't minimize that. But I mean, if Michelle Obama wants to run in 2020, just to sort of pick something out of my, you know, just out of the air, does she even have to run for the Senate? I mean, you know, I mean, it's...
Dick Durbin hopes that's...
Yes, that she otherwise she'll knock him off Illinois in 2018.
Yeah, I think...
Or does she, you know, do people... Or do others... We were talking about this in our office this morning. I mean, why exactly doesn't Oprah or someone look at this and think, well, the key is to be very famous, pretty well-liked, at least by your own party, though Trump had actually high negatives, but she, I'm sure, has much higher positives. Have your own, like, media. That's very important, mm-hmm. I think. That's sort of an insight Trump had, right? That you both, you know, dominate, in Harris's case, Fox News, and in effect you buy or you rent or you persuade Breitbart to be your house organ. And so you have a real way of getting stuff out to your supporters, at least. And then, of course, you use social media as well. Oprah has her magazine. I mean, you could sort of imagine, I don't know, it's not totally crazy to me that Oprah or, you know, any of 20 other very wealthy celebrity actors or actresses or businessmen or women or, you know, or sports or athletes could be competitive in 2020 with, you know, Tim Kaine or whoever the kind of conventional, you know, Looper, I mean, all the governors and the senators. I mean, would you bet against Michelle Obama or Oprah against one of those people?
The Trump model has a much higher probability of being replicated, I think, because of super PACs. You know, it used to be that the candidates in each party had to go out and raise $20 or $30 million just right. to kind of make the ante to be part of the game through Iowa, New Hampshire, and maybe South Carolina. And getting $20 million in $2,000 per head donations meant 10,000 people had to be on your team. And to get to that point required a far broader base of initial support. Now, with the super PAC situation, you can convince five prosperous Americans who've been dying all their life to be on the innermost circle of a presidential campaign and subsequent presidency to put you into the $20 million club right off the bat. And so that's why I think in no small measure the Republican field was so large this year, because there were a lot of people who could find five or eight or ten or whatever cohorts to convinced they could be the decision makers, and they could be the president's kitchen cabinet. I think you'll see more of that. And in a setting with a lot of traditional candidates, governors, senators, whatever, cabinet members, a well-known celebrity like Trump can emerge because these others kind of look the same.
Yeah. And my colleague, like you talked to the Secretary, but my colleague Jonathan Lassman also made a very good observation. We're having this kind of similar conversation in the office this morning. And he said, well, also, why did wealthy celebrities, wealthy businessmen and women, tend not to run? They did run sometimes, of course, with Senate and Governor and even President, but tend to shy away often in the past. They've had sort of complicated personal lives, a lot of these Hollywood types, right?
Right.
And that would be a disqualification, allegedly, if someone looked into that too closely. What's the lesson of Trump on that? Not really. And B, you know, you have to do things like release your tax returns, and suddenly people find out things you kind of prefer to keep quiet. Guess what? Do future candidates have to release their tax returns now? We just elected someone president who didn't, you know? So I do wonder if you're, I mean, I'm making these names up, if you're George Clooney or Kanye West or Eddie, or if a business, Steyer, the fellow who funds all the environment, why does he keep on funding candidates who are environmentalists? Why doesn't he just run himself, you know? I mean, he probably knows more about it than most of these politicians he's funding.
Well, you know, Trump Tom had Steyer. An insight.
You know, I mean, that's where I do wonder, this is sort of a barrier to entry, footnote to the barriers to entry. So you don't have to release your tax returns. You don't have to be embarrassed anymore about personal, you know, issues in your
peccadilloes.
Yeah. So, I don't know.
Nor statements you made on tape, on television, right, that would be massively embarrassing.
So, really, I mean, I do think the kind of people who might think about running in 2018, 2020 state for a state level as well, obviously, and federal office, and then for president is just going to be much broader than it has been in the past. Trump's got to stimulate other people to think, hey, he did that. You know?
Well, this is the John F. Kennedy effect, too, is that when Kennedy ran in 1960, Eleanor Roosevelt walked out of the convention in Los Angeles because she thought, who's this backbencher jumping the line? It's Adlai's turn. Right. It belongs to Adlai, you know? Kennedy should have been behind LBJ and Adlai Stevenson and even arguably Symington.
And Humphrey.
Yeah. I mean, there was a whole list, but Kennedy had a personal touch that he was able to take onto the trail, and isn't that exactly what?
And
Jimmy,
the money. And that the was money. Not trivial.
And isn't
money.
That Jimmy Carter followed the same path in 1976,
right?
And Bill Clinton followed the same path in 1992. And I mean, this is why this gets back to a previous comment you made that I do political science, but I'm skeptical of the science. Is because the president is a trailblazer. The president can create new paths of political success that didn't exist before. That they're almost like explorers going out, and they come back and say, "Oh, I found a passage," you know. And they have enormous downstream effects, not just on politics and sort of this idea of a hierarchy of political experience that's required, because. That's the other thing, is that did Obama not also follow the same John F. Kennedy model, or is this people who had a direct contact with the voters but didn't really have the biography? This is not to say that Trump followed it, it's just to say that Kennedy revolutionized it, and I totally agree that Trump could very well revolutionize it as well.
It's or if he fails, I guess there could be a reaction, and the parties will nominate the most, experienced.
Safest choices.
Yeah.
Right? Well, we'll see, but I do think
it's
in the world
to unwind that.
I think the money situation has changed, and that is, I think, the very significant part of it, because there really is... you no longer have to get thousands of people to back you to be able to sustain a campaign because either you can go the Trump route and have a campaign that's not spending that much money but reaching voters effectively, or you can go the other route and derive from a much smaller number of people, the resources you need to get at least through the first few stages of the process.
And Sanders, I mean, what he did, it's sort of built on the Howard Dean example, but you can be an insurgent and raise hundreds of millions of dollars, and he is not personally a young, charismatic fellow. So, I mean, it does, again, make you think if you're sitting out there and you've been derided as a fringe guy who's, to the left or right of his party, and you could never have a chance, really? That was what Bernie Sanders was at the beginning of 2015, and the guy
got 45% of the vote.
14 million votes or something, is now a power probably in the Senate, I guess, in their party, in the Democratic Party. So,
I think as people... and again, it depends how Trump performs, but I think your point's well made. And I think there's got to be plenty of individuals now who are going to say, well, if Donald Trump could go from where he was to the presidency, I can certainly go to the State House.
Right.
I can certainly go to the Senate. I think your point earlier that, nobody's going to feel that deferential to some 18-year congressman when they could just sort of jump into the ring and compete right from day one.
It also raises the question of within the Republican Party, does Trump, in effect, threaten to primary senators and congressmen with, favorites? I mean, that hasn't happened in a long time. And it tends to backfire, FDR and 38 and stuff, but I don't know. I mean, it's a different era also in terms of Let me ask finally, though, this has been, I think, stimulating to me at least, I hope to others. I mean, it's going to be so much noise over the next weeks and months and so much activity and stuff. I mean, any one, two, three things you would watch just kind of, you know, to step back and say, okay, where are we politically? Is Trump succeeding or not? Is the party balance shifting or not? Or some, you know, is there any, I mean, what would you be sort of looking for? I mean, do you think he needs to be stronger on January 20th than he is today in terms of approval, disapproval? Do you think he...
I don't think it's likely he will be.
Okay.
Because I do think that he will not enjoy any kind of balanced coverage or truce with the Democrats or even with some of the Republicans. I think he has to therefore go the other route, which is to be decisive, to fulfill commitments, to work to the degree he can with Congress to move some legislative items while he's taking executive action. I think he needs to name a Supreme Court nominee as soon as he can and use that as a way to unite Republicans behind him and satisfy any Republicans who were questioning his sincerity as a conservative. Those are the sort of steps he's going to have to take.
So you think by February 1st he should have a lot of these things going if they're in drag down an internal debate and indecision, you would regard that as a bad sign. Yeah, that's interesting. Jay, you have any thoughts on that?
I'm not quite that far along yet, my sort of thinking. I want to see...
Which stage of grief are you in? I can't remember those five. Is it seven stages? Five stages?
Seven.
Denial, anger. I like
negotiation.
Them all.
Negotiation. The election really wasn't decided
I'm
yet.
I'm more in denial and anger, but that's okay. You know, right?
What I want to see is, I mean, obviously Trump I'm really interested to see how he chooses to staff the government and also the West Wing. So any president in Trump's position is going to want loyalists with him, people who were with him before everybody else was. Okay, so that goes without saying. But Trump, as an insurgent who did not have the, you know, hearts and minds of the Republican establishment or whatever you want to call it, has, I think, a talent problem among his loyalists. Like he's not going to be like George W. Bush, right? Where George W. Bush had the entire Republican infrastructure had been loyal to him from day one. So I think what I'm looking for Trump to do is to balance, make sure he's got loyalists in the government, but also make sure that he is bringing people into the government who are qualified and intelligent and ready to actually take care of the daily drudgery of actually governing the country and making sure the laws are faithfully executed. And so, like, for instance, so as of now, you know, the only official appointment we've gotten is Reince Priebus. And I think that as chief of staff, I think that was a very good pick from that perspective. As Priebus was a guy who had been, you know, studiously neutral during the primaries, and whereas Never Trumpers such as you and I were sort of arguing that he needs to throw in against Trump, he didn't do that. So I can appreciate Trump trusts him, but Priebus is also a guy who knows how the city of Washington works and has good contacts, but coming as he does from Wisconsin, will have his door, Paul Ryan's doors always open him. I want to see more people like that. And also maybe stepping out of Trump's traditional comfort zone and bringing in people who weren't maybe with Trump from the beginning, but are invested in his success now. And who bring a knowledge base and experiential base to help actually run the country.
Spence, you were cabinet secretary. I mean, what about that?
Well, I think Jay's making a good point. I think we have the two models of Carter and Reagan. You know, Carter chose to bring all of these Georgia political figures, you know, the Burt Lances and others to Washington, Hamilton, Jordan, and so on, to be his inner circle. Not that they weren't capable people, but he went for the loyalty test first and foremost. And Reagan, as everybody remembers, shocked, you know, many of his closest supporters when Jim Baker was named chief of staff.
Right.
But at the same time, he had Ed Meese, and he had Lynn Nofziger, and he had Jim Watt, and he had others who clearly demonstrated that he was not going native, if you would, across the board. He was going to go for talent, but maintain his philosophical moorings. And that's, you know, that was a pretty effective model, and Carter's model wasn't all that effective. So we'll see. I mean, obviously Trump will be somewhere else. I mean, there's not, you know, only two choices here, but I think if he's looking at the history of successful presidencies, he's got to look at Reagan's and say, you know, that Reagan did a nice balance between loyalists and people that were professionals at running the country.
If you look at the last three chief of staff picks, the first one, Clinton picked Mac McClarty, George W. Bush picked Andy Card, and Barack Obama picked Rahm Emanuel. I think all three of those are really indicative of how the first half of the first term went for those three, and the relationship that the president had toward Congress and the public. And so I think that those of us who were never Trump and who are, you know, worried, I think that when I heard that he had picked Priebus.
Yeah, it just doesn't got clear how powerful Priebus would be, though, compared to Steve Bannon, who's going to be his counselor. Steve Bannon's going
to
be Karl Rove.
I'm trying to be optimistic, Bill.
No, but I'd say that. So I'm not even being optimistic about this. I think the key, I sort of agree with what you both said, but I would just, I think there are two or three appointments that are really important, though. Attorney General.
Right.
I mean, first of all, it's really important in and of itself. B, people kind of have doubts about Trump and the rule of law, I think it's fair to say, and how faithful he'll be to that and respectful. And having a strong Attorney General who's, he can be a strong conservative, can be a strong Trump supporter, but I think he has to be respected. He has to himself appoint people whom, and this is where you have to go a little establishment mainstream, I think, to places like the Office of Legal Counsel and others where people say, yes, that is a serious lawyer, and he's not going to sort of allow Trump to do things that are unconstitutional or illegal.
And someone so just, Federalist Society.
Yes,
people.
Yeah. Right. Yes, totally.
And the Federalist Society now would be seen as like a mainstream.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
Which you helped found, you know, 30 years ago. You know, I very much agree with that, though. You want your high-quality conservative, right, you know, ideologue, so to speak, and people can say, and people will say, okay, it's not just some, you know, it can't be Trump's personal lawyer from a casino somewhere.
Right.
Who got him? Kept him out of jail in Atlantic City when he, you know, when he took advantage of all those people there or something. I mean, I think that's a pretty big difference. And I think also in foreign policy, I mean, a couple of people who very hard. I mean, Reagan was an interesting mix where he had people he trusted personally, Bill Clark and others, but he had Haig, who was he inherited sort of from Kissinger, you might say. That turned out to be kind of a fiasco, but then he brought in George Shultz, and that worked out pretty well. So I think in those areas, if Trump errs a little bit on the side of establishment types, yeah, you should have he'll have a ton of loyalists, obviously. But I do think it matters also just in governing, as you know, Spence, you've been there. I mean, if you want to undo all these executive orders,
you have to know
contrary to the, you know, the kind of way people talk about it, you can't actually just run a line through it. You know, these are executive orders.
Right.
They have to be unwound. You have to have notice and comment. This is where your smart Federalist Society lawyers who've worked in, right, you know, government a little bit before at a lower level can come in and say, okay, we're going to make sure this is done right. So otherwise, you're going to get a legal challenge and it'll go to a judge and it'll be an Obama appointee, and suddenly you're prize immigration executive order reversing Obama's executive orders is thrown out and you're back to having this. You know what I mean? It could really be, it'll be a mess.
I think
anyway.
You make a very good point, and I do think he will need top legal talent both in the White House and in the Department of Justice, because not only will he have to deal with those sorts of issues, but almost undoubtedly he will be under assault.
Right.
Whether it's in the form of lawsuits or it's in the form of people who are trying to FOIA the government for who knows what or challenges on ethics, I think he will be targeted from day one. And having a competent team in the legal, both in the Office of Legal Counsel at the White House and at DOJ, is central to his success.
And experienced, I think. So.
Yes.
So
when Obama
final
was,
point.
Yeah, final point. So when Obama was, I still remember this like it was yesterday, when Obama was the president-elect and he picked Emanuel and he was staffing the government, and somebody said, well, I thought you were going to be a change, you know. And he said, well, I'm the change. This is what he said. He said, I'm the change, and so I can bring on in all these old Clinton people. And I thought, at the time, I thought, well, that was supremely arrogant. But in fact, I think that was very intelligent of him to sort of say, you know, there's a sort of establishment, or there's just a group of people who have the knowledge to actually run the government, and I have to have them. My goal, my job, my task as president is to yoke them to the purpose that I laid out to the people, to say, you do your job, but we're going to tilt, you were tilted this way, we're going to tilt it that way, and that's what I do. Rather than bringing in a bunch of new people who don't have that experience, because I think you're exactly right. If he doesn't have people in there who know what they're doing, then he's going to fail. He won't succeed.
And those people are neither you nor I are lawyers, but Spence is, you know, a founder of the Federalist Society, a former senator. I think you're the ideal person. I'm just saying I'm just speculating out loud.
I'd have to give up lucrative gigs like this. And I'm not sure I could.
That's a good point. The ethics lawyer would tell you, I'm sorry, Mr. Attorney General, you can't appear on conversations with Bill Kristol.
That's right.
Thank you both for appearing on this conversation, which I found enlightening, and I'm sure our viewers have as well. And thank you for joining us.